This podcast is protected by copyright and not for broadcast. See rsn.net.au for more details.
Welcome to the Talking Horses full interview with the most famous horseman on the planet, the legendary Monty Roberts, who was recently in Australia attending the yearling sales in Melbourne. In this conversation, we cover lots of territory. His views on Australian horsemen, the champion mare Winx, how he mended the ways of Hong Kong's wayward racehorse Pakistan Star, the death threats he's received over the years, and he shares his views on what went wrong with Chautauqua. He defends the Grey Flash and says, contrary to opinion, he wants to race. Hope you enjoy this amazing insight from Monty Roberts. Monty, it's fantastic to see you here in Australia. What brought you down under?
Oh, curiosity, excitement, driven. I was first in Australia in, I think it was either 66 or 67, 1966 or 1967, I think. They were building the Opera House in Sydney when I was there. And Australia has been an interesting place for me, and one of the most malleable countries on the face of this earth that I have watched change dramatically just in my lifetime. And I think most people would agree that it's changed in their lifetime, even if they're half my age. So I came back with a lot of thoughts, a lot of ideas and goals. We'll see.
Goals, what would some of those be?
Learning more and causing horses to have a better life if I can. My life's goal is to leave the world a better place than I found it, for horses and for people too. And since I met Her Majesty in 1989, there has been an enormous effort by her to get me to keep going, and it's 43 countries now that she's had me in, exploring my concepts in violence-free training.
And that is essentially what you're about, the join-up method you're absolutely globally renowned for. Going back to a very young age, non-violent management of horses has been your number one passion.
Yes, I suppose you could say. But an early age for most people would be 12 or 13 or 14, something like that. And an early age for me was 4, 5, and 6, when I wasn't sure why there was so much violence going on in the world of training horses. I was told it had to be done. You don't like it, turn your head. And I did. I thought it has to be done. I really don't like it because I loved Ginger, my first horse. And I showed him first. And in 1939, I have a trophy that I won in 1939 for first place in a class. But I never went to school, remember? I had a teacher on the road with me, and I was a professional horseman from birth, practically. So I was riding 8 or 9 hours a day because my father had a riding school. And in order to get all the parents to send their children to his riding school, his son had to win everything. So I did. Naturally, I won everything. These kids rode for an hour on Saturday afternoon, and I rode 8 to 9 hours a day. So it was a different life. And I had wonderful guidance from a few human beings that kept me from being violent. Because when you are imprinted to violence, it's true that you tend to be violent. And children are often about like their parents are. That's behaviors for you. And I have 2 doctorates in behavioral sciences that will tell me that. You're going to be like your father. And I wasn't. I changed it, beginning probably in about 1946, 47, and the Mustangs really changed me. There was an unnamed Mustang that they put in a dog food can. And he really changed me. He was the first horse to decide to come to me as opposed to going away. And that was 1946 or 47. And that's when I said, who is going to apologize to this species? Who's going to realize that all this that we're doing to them is not necessary and it's immoral?
You have a theory that horses speak a language. You call it equus?
Yes, except that John Grinder, the creator of neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, has been to my farm and he says, stop calling it a language. It's a communication system. Language refers to the lingua, the tongue. And there is no speaking language by a horse. But I'm watching you and there's a communication system. And it's a lot like signing for the deaf. It's a sign language. They have their signs, and we have signs, and they, when you study behavioral sciences, you realize that more of our language comes from our bodies than it comes from our tongue. The words don't really mean that much. It's attitude and what you're talking about, and are you excited about it? Are you negative? Are you positive? That's where communication really comes in. And the horses have it in the form of gestures. So it's a gesture language. And it's predictable, discernible, and effective. And World Book and Encyclopedia Britannica have been to my place, and they were shocked to their shoes, because when I was a child, all the encyclopedias said there was no communication system between horse and human. But there is.
Mm.
And I can tell them what the horse is going to do next by what he told me. And then he does it. Okay, nothing like seeing it to believe it.
And that has earned you the reference globally as the horse whisperer.
Well, yes. But Queen Victoria brought a man over from America to fix a stallion that she had. And someone asked Queen Victoria, what does he do with these horses? And she said, I don't know. I think he just takes them out behind the barn and whispers to them. Oh, so he's a horse whisperer. Well, that title came down through the ages. And then the man who wrote the book, The Horse Whisperer, decided that was the title that he wanted to put on it after coming to one of my demonstrations. And then he wanted me to assist him in writing that book. And Queen Elizabeth II, granddaughter of Queen Victoria, said, if there's any fiction in that book at all, I don't want you near it. I want a book from you that is dead on the truth. And I don't want you to deal with anybody that writes anything fictional. And she was so right. I stayed away from it. And I don't do the things that they wrote in that book. And I don't do the things that they put in the movie.
Mm.
They're completely against what I do. So she was right.
Hmm. And so you wrote your own book.
So I wrote my own book, and I was just down the street from Buckingham Palace visiting with publishers there, and they were sort of laughing at me. Ah, come on, you know, those books won't sell. All right? Horse books don't sell, and we do books that sell. And so I went back to Buckingham Palace and met with Her Majesty and she went straight down to Methuen Publishings with me. And she said, I want a book. And then they took me in the boardroom and she went back to Buckingham Palace and they said, look, if the Queen wants a book, we'll print a book. But there won't be any residuals. And there will be no advance. You won't get any money for it. And I said, hey, I didn't even want to write a book. But if the Queen wants a book, and she has one for her nightstand, and I have one for mine, I'm happy. So if you want to print it, fine. Well, they went out of business before I published my book. And Random House stepped in and gave me something, I don't know, $300,000 or something advance. Because they said it is a book. And it will sell. Hmm. And was she right? 6.5 million copies later. The Man Who Listens to Horses. And then they wanted to call it The Man Who Talks to Horses. And I said, I don't talk to horses. And I said, the better part of communication is listening. And that's how it got its name.
That book, The Man Who Listens to Horses, was the number one bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list for 58 weeks.
Can you imagine a cowboy from California? No other horseman has ever had a book even get on that list for a day. And to be on there for over a year, 58 weeks, I got a full-page ad in the New York Times about my book being on there going over the year. And there's only, of the books published, there's only about 1% that stay on for over a year. Incredible. I don't know how I got so lucky.
Because a lot of the readers would be a non-horsey readership, which makes it even more extraordinary.
There just weren't that many horsemen around there. You're right. It had to be cross-spectrum, cross-discipline.
So you must feel very fulfilled that your message got carried to the world in such a way.
Fulfilled, I don't know about. I count myself as very lucky, but I'm not fulfilled. I haven't done a tenth of what I would like to do. And I will go in a box wanting to do more because it needs to be done. And my God, when you see some of the things that are done today with horses, this day, we're still scratching the surface. They've been domesticated for 6,000 years and we're still acting like we have no idea what a flight animal is. I went to Hong Kong to work with Pakistan Star. And he stops in the middle of the race. And I was flying there on the airplane thinking, oh God, I feel guilty. I'm going there to get a fee to tell them how to fix a horse that stops in the middle of the race. And I've never seen a horse do it before. I don't know what I'm talking about. And I got there. And 20 minutes into the session of training that I saw, I said to the trainer, Ray Charles could see what's going on with this horse, and he got very upset with me. But in 6 weeks, he won $4.5 million. And the change was, I was only there 2 days. But that's how far off we are.
So what was it that they were doing wrong in his training that led to those behavioural issues in the races?
Well, you see, it has to be a beautiful track and it has grass on it. So you can train that way away from his house and just stop up there and turn around and come back to his house because the people don't see that part of the track. But you can't go around that turn and go through the finish line and then go home because you'll mess up the turf. And I said, this horse wants to stop, whirl around and go back home rather than make the turn. Oh, well, the trainer said, the stewards will never let you take him around there anyway, you know. And I said, I guess I have to have a meeting with the stewards. This is the first day. I met the nicest man called Kim Kelly. He's a chief steward, Sha Tin Racing. And I drew on a napkin in the breakfast room what was wrong. And, of course, they have a little dirt thing out here and a nice big turf track over here. And I said, if he could just come around here and go on the dirt track, even at a trot, I don't care, and come down here and put a little gate here and let him go home. Boom. Round the turn he went, $4.5 million later. And then they gave him a month off or so. And I got an email from the veterinarian of the stable where he was saying they went right back training him the way they did before and said, Monty Roberts doesn't know what he's talking about. And he stopped again. I mean, how do you help people? I can help horses way easier than people. Way easier. People are so entrenched in tradition. I was thrown out of the Hall of Fame, you know. I won 11 world championships in the Western world. 11 world championships. I was in the Hall of Fame for 30 years. And after my first book came out, they threw me out of the Hall of Fame.
Why?
I called and said, what did I do wrong? They said, you don't respect tradition. And I said, look, here, listen to me carefully. If I have to not improve anything, not move forward, not learn anything in order to stay in your Hall of Fame, I don't want to be in that Hall of Fame. And I wish some of my friends weren't in there, because that's the wrong attitude to have. Well, that's what it is, and you're going to have to live with it. And they threw my horse out. My best horse was in the Hall of Fame with me. They threw him out.
So you've had your challenges along this journey, haven't you?
Come on. My life has been threatened hundreds of times. And they flew me out of three different places because the fix was on. I was going to be killed.
Why would someone want to do that?
Oh, you're making a mockery of every good horseman that ever lived. And you can say I'm wrong if you want, but you can't say my daddy was wrong. He was the greatest horseman ever. And the things he did, you're complaining that we shouldn't do to horses. You got to die. And you're going to die tomorrow night in Twin Falls, Idaho. And I'm going to shoot you. And he happened to be sitting in a car with this new thing they call a mobile phone, calling my hotel room to tell me this. And the man on the desk called the police, and they arrested him on the spot and took a screw-together assault rifle out of the boot of his car. I was going to die the next night in Twin Falls, Idaho.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. In Vancouver, way down in Brazil and Argentina, they were going to kill me there. Put me on television saying that I told the people to do this to the horse so that a video could be made, and then I could complain about the violence. We don't really do it this way here in Brazil. This is just, he set it up. They put me on, a television station said those things. So, yeah, I've had my challenges.
Mm. What's your perception of the Australian horse world, and in particular, our racing industry?
Well, first of all, let me give you the positives, because Australia has so far outrun any of the other racing countries. It isn't even comparable in terms of bringing the public into racing, in terms of making it more attractive to the general public walking on the street. I just give them so much credit. It is incredible. And when I first came down here, I bought Tobin Bronze down here for Charlie Whittingham and took him back to my farm in California and trained him there. And I got to know the people here, and I leased a farm in New Zealand, Alton Lodge Farm in the Waikato. And so I got really loving it down here because they had old staying mares and we had speed in California, and I could retire a 1200 meter winning group one, like they didn't even have group races in those days, but top notch race in California, could bring him down here and cross him with these old mares and get some more speed in it. And I've watched Australia go from stayers to sprinters like crazy. They're built differently, they walk differently, they think differently. And it's all advanced into a more modern type racing industry, which I give them great credit for. And they're hospitable people. The Australians are hardworking people, and they're hospitable. They mean well. They look you in the eye. They talk to you like human beings should, not so much like city folk. And I know the cities are growing and things change, but Australia is still a bit old-fashioned in that term of being hospitable to one another. I just came from the sale, Inglis. And they were so hospitable, you can't believe it. They're just so nice. And they do things for everybody that they think might be a buyer, you know. And look at the excitement that they drew out of the general public at Inglis. I was very impressed. Those are all the positives. They just have to, in my opinion, Australia has to be very careful about integrity, making sure that people aren't doing things to the general public that the general public doesn't know about, that they have to be fair with the horses and with the people, and not maybe be quite as hard on horses at times, thinking, well, I got 10 of them, I'll go as fast as I can and the best one will pay for the rest, you know. And there's some truth in that, but I'm on the side of the horses, and you can just count me on that. If I have a fault, it's to be too kind to them rather than to be demanding.
There's never been a bigger focus, which I'm sure you're very pleased about, on horse welfare, particularly in racing here in Australia. It's as high a focus as there's ever been. What are your views about that?
Well, of course, that's fantastic. And we just have to be careful that it's all well meant and properly done. For instance, let's ban all two-year-old racing. That would be so bad for the horses. Why? Horses shouldn't race when they're two. That's your decision. I say that if you ban two-year-old racing, then each farm would have to have individual paddocks for all the males. You couldn't run them in a group after puberty. You just couldn't do it. They'd be so bashed up you wouldn't get them to a sale. So then you would have two-year-old sales instead of yearling sales, because you've got to add a year to it. You can't ask the buyers to keep them for an extra year for nothing, you know, to do nothing. So I say race your two-year-olds as much as you want to race them, so long as they're an A of their epiphyseal closures. Well, that would reduce two-year-old racing a lot. They can scan them now as they walk by in the saddling paddock, the mounting yard, you call it. You can scan them right there, boom. They're not an A, they don't race at two. And if they're an A, they're fully mature. Oh, well, when do they become an A then? Well, in our northern hemisphere, it's generally September, October that the two-year-old becomes an A. So you'd get rid of the two-year-old races in February, March, April, and May. That's for sure. There's just not enough A's. But you wouldn't want to race them when they're immature, would you? You love your horses. You wouldn't want to do that. That's my position. That's what I say at every meeting up there. And the trainers are against me. They want to go, you know, get it done. Boom, boom, boom. And if the growth plates are still immature, they're going to break down more often. And you might get one through, too. I'm not saying that they break down 100%. But if it's an A, I say it's okay.
How do you regard Australian horsemen at the moment, generally?
I regard all horsemen on the face of this earth to be scratching the surface of what we need to learn, including me. I make mistakes every day. I saw a mistake today that I made. My boots are muddy right now. And I was working with all the babies I advised on at Inglis. And I saw some mistakes that I made in my scoring. We make mistakes. It's learning from those mistakes that we have to do. And so I regard all horsemen on the face of the earth as scratching the surface. To me, our greatest trainers ever, oh, he was monumental, da, 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 as being a neophyte in what we need to know to really be the best we can be for the horses. And that doesn't put me in, I'm not bragging about me, that I know more than anybody else. I have some idols in the horse industry. Charlie Whittingham was one of my idols, and I got Tobin Bronze for him here. Farrell W. Jones was one of my idols, and I had dozens of champions with him. And my wife and I led the world for 18 years in the production of two-year-olds in breeze-up sales to go into racing. We led the world. And I had alleged Horse of the World twice, won the Arc de Triomphe when it was the best race on earth, twice. And I'm scratching the surface. So don't count me as any smarter than the next guy. It's just that I want to learn more. And maybe the next guy who's considered an idol now needs to learn more too. I think we all do.
You mentioned the yearling sales, and you've been here in Melbourne for the English sales this week, looking at yearlings and buying them on behalf of a client. How was that experience?
It was fun. It was an incredible experience. You wouldn't think that some guy, 84 years old, that has done everything you would think about in the horse industry, 52 disciplines I've operated in at world-class level, 52 different disciplines. How could he get excited about going to another sale? I tell you, I was on cloud nine. I was in absolute joyous condition out there the whole time, seeing good horses, some bad horsemanship, but kids coming to me saying, show me how to do better. Show me how to get this horse to have a better overstride. And looking at me as though I had information for them, that is such a good feeling. And I don't mean it that I know that more than anybody else, but by golly, I've been in this thing a long time. And if I haven't accumulated a fair bit of information by now, something is very wrong. But there's some hungry kids out there, and the next generation will get a lot better than the generation before. It really will. We're moving away from the old traditional horsemanship very rapidly.
What were your impressions of the horse flesh that you saw and purchased?
The impressions I have of the horse flesh that I saw, and then some that I purchased too, was that it's unique for me to see these horses in Australia with the big bottoms. As Dwayne Lucas says in America, I want my horses, particularly my fillies, to have a face like Marilyn Monroe and a backside like a washerwoman. Big backsides they have, and they can really go up the racetrack. I see more overstride on the horses today than I've ever seen, because I think early on the UK bloodstock agents really introduced that overstride walking to the world of horsemanship, and it didn't take long for people to pick up on it and realize that those horses take fewer steps in a mile than the average horse, the horse without a big overstride. So if you take fewer steps, you get less exhausted and you win more races. And the ones that have the feet going north and south instead of east and west are better. I mean, across the body axis or in line with the body axis. The riding of the horses in the races is going to change dramatically in Australia in the next few years, in my opinion. At 84, what am I going to say about that? How much am I going to change? I'm going to change as much as I can, because the riding is way, way behind what the best riders in the world are doing. And it's not just simply somebody's opinion. You can prove the anatomical challenges that riders are giving horses. You can prove it. It is scientifically provable that doing some of the things that the riders do here is costing horses distance or time or links. For instance, horses, well, you can just go there with that, because They ride differently in Australia. Anytime you see a rider come to Santa Anita in California and ride, he looks very different from the rest of the riders. And if you see a rider go to England and ride from Australia, they look so much different from the rest of the riders, or Germany or anywhere. And so if they look that much different, then why aren't the other ones getting closer to what they look like if it's the best thing? Well, it's not the best thing.
In a nutshell, what are they doing wrong, Jim?
Well, yeah, I'd rather not go into that because I don't want to seem like... I rode my first race in 1946, and I was a jockey. Second World War time, when the jockeys were off at war. So I've been there in the jockey side. I rode from the first starting stall used in California that had springs on it where all the gates opened at the same time. The ones before that had a thing, they pulled the gate, I think it went up or something. The starting stalls themselves, the barriers, are dead wrong. They're dead wrong. But they've invested so much in supplying all the barriers for all the tracks that they just laugh at you when you say you ought to change this, because they'd have to change them all, you know? But they're wrong. And I can prove they're wrong. And yeah, that's part of Chautauqua's problem, is the way the stalls are made.
It's a pretty traumatic experience for a horse in the barriers, isn't it?
Sure it is. Horses were created by God to be on a grassy plain somewhere where they could see about a mile in each direction and have grass in front of them, and to flee anything that seemed unsafe. They were not horses that would go into a tight place. They're claustrophobic to the 10th power. All horses are. And part of my work today was to cause horses not to lean into the rails in the barrier. But they do, because they want out of that place. And there's a lot of reasons why they don't go out of the barrier when the gates come open. There's reasons why they lean over in there and their feet are in the stall next to them rather than in theirs. There's reasons why they try to kick the back out of the barriers. And we human beings tend to close our eyes to these reasons. I don't. I keep an open mind and I keep my eyes open and I study, why is this horse doing that? But you're right. It is a traumatic experience for them to go in there. It doesn't have to be quite as traumatic as it is. But we tend to add to that trauma. Oh, when the gates fly open, just give him a good crack across the hind legs. Oh, good. And so the next time he goes in there, he's rolling his eyes straight back to see where the whack is coming from. Not a good idea. Didn't work. That's my life.
Winx, the champion mare, not just of Australia, but the world now. How much have you enjoyed seeing her race?
Oh, well, when we watched Black Caviar, you know, everybody said, you'll never see another one like that again. And I tended to believe them. I was there in England when she raced there, and Black Caviar was the greatest of her time, and maybe better than Secretariat. I don't know. Secretariat's our famous one. And along comes Winx and eclipses, in one generation, eclipses Black Caviar. Get out of here. That can't happen. And I watched on racing.com, and I watched this morning this fellow winning some huge race here. It wasn't the Melbourne Cup. It was something else, I think, but he said, oh, there isn't a child in this audience that will ever see this happen again.
That was Lee Friedman when Mackayvi Diva won her third Melbourne
Cup. That's the one. Was it Melbourne Cup?
Mm.
What a mare. And there will never be a child in this audience see this again. And look what's happened in my lifetime, not just that child's lifetime. And who knows, maybe there's another one coming. Yeah. One thing about it is that Australia is a tough place. People are tough. They came here digging ditches and farming, and they're tough people. People of the soil, they're tough people. And horses that come here are living with tough people and living a tough life in some cases. And the ones that come through that are the toughest. And maybe, you know, it's the kids from the other side of the tracks that win in the boxing match and the wrestling match and the this and that. The what is that game they play? Not soccer, but...
A football, AFL?
No, but yeah. I'm thinking of the one they Wales is so good in. Where they have the ball that's...
Aussie rules.
Not Aussie rules.
No, Gaelic football.
What?
Gaelic football?
No.
Rugby.
Rugby. They bash one another down. That's Aussie stuff, you know? And there's no violence in that because there's a different color jersey on either one of them. And the rules are there. And it's okay to bash him down. So it's not violent. But it turns out to be sometimes injurious, if not violent. But Aussie people and Aussie horses are tough. And I think that's where the major champions come from, because this one made it through that tough world out there. And me, I'm for trying to make the trip a little easier for everybody so that you get there and let talent take over rather than just being the survivor, you know.
We tend to try very hard to define and analyze what makes horses like Black Caviar and Winx as great as they are. Scientific testing, measurement of stride, heart rate, all of those things. But beyond that, what's the Monty Roberts perspective on what makes a horse like Winx amazing?
When I came here, Daryl's Joy was a big horse in those early days, and I bought him. And the vet turned him down, wouldn't ship him to California because they said his QRS complex was not good enough. He had a weakness in his heart. And my buyer in California, the man putting up the money, said, well, I'm not taking him anyway. And he followed us right over there, and he won $1.5 million or something in California. Made a fool of me, that's for sure. And we don't have the answer yet. And maybe there is an X factor here that none of us are ever going to see. I'm not going to see it because at 84, I'm not going to see much more. But isn't it a joy when there are people out there still looking and trying to make life better for these animals? I just love it. And I don't know whether we'll ever analyze all of what God does, or creator, or whatever you want to call it. Maybe it's a cloud of gases that run this whole thing. I don't know. But the creation of a species is a very interesting thing. They say that just off your west coast, you know, that that's where life began, in those round stones off Perth there in the sea. And that it's one-celled amoeba that got trapped in the calcium of the outer layers of the stone that created the first animals on Earth. And they upgraded from there to become everything we see. Elephants and humans and lions and tigers. Who knows? I mean, we keep studying, and I went through every cave in Europe studying. Did you know that there were no indigenous horses on North America? And I never could figure that one out. But now it's been discovered that there were indigenous horses, and they're still frozen up there in the Yukon territory somewhere. So we get things wrong, we get things right, we keep trying, you know. There's drawings in the caves in Europe of a child on hands and knees nursing from a mare. How could that be? Well, it was small mares. Yeah, but how could that be? And then you think about it, and a mare could have a foal die when giving birth. And a human mother could die and leave a baby crying, and a mare could adopt a baby. It could happen. Look me in the eye. I'm going to tell you something that is absolutely, you can put a polygraph on me. I have been adopted by a mare in my lifetime. That tried to kill the saddle, ripped it to shreds, and I went away and got down in fetal position by the fence. And the mare came running at me, and I thought I was the next part of the menu. And she stood over me, wearing these kind of jeans that I have on right now. And I heard on the back of my leg. I looked down, and both of my legs, she's dripping milk on me. And when she looked at the saddle, her ears went flat back. And when she looked down at me, the ears came forward. And her feet were going a mile a minute on the ground, but she never stepped on me. Now, with that in mind, I started really hard studying the behavior of horses. And I was in a cave in Mexico, on the east coast of Mexico, in the oldest seemingly civilized area for humans. And I saw a drawing in a cave. And it's all covered now with an acrylic thing that keeps it from being destroyed. A child, hands and knees, nursing a mare. Now, they didn't paddle across the ocean. There were horses over here on our side. And those same horses had the same tendencies to nurture that they had in Hungary, Czech Republic, and even Turkey, those caves over there. So I'm telling you, we're scratching the surface. We have no idea.
What is it you love so much about the horse?
No horse has ever lied. They can't alter the truth. They can only act on the moment. It's true. They can't think about tomorrow. They only remember yesterday. And they will respond to things that are similar about yesterday. And they never forget yesterday. Ever. They have the best memory on earth. And they never alter the truth. We human beings alter the truth about 52% of the time. It might be a slight alteration. It might be the way we remembered it. But there's some alteration of the truth. And some of it's a flat-out lie. A lot of it is a flat-out lie. The polygraph was a big step forward, but people have learned to beat the polygraph as well. That's why it's still not available in the courtroom. It's not perfect. So, but it was a step in the right direction to determine what it is about the human anatomy that tells us whether we're telling the truth or not. I just learned something the other day. I've been telling people since 1967 or something like that, that Charivari, a stallion that I sent to New Zealand, won 2 national championships in 24 hours. He won a sprint championship of racing, thoroughbred stallion. And 24 hours later, he won the mile championship. What? 2 races in 24 hours? I told the guy I had managing the horse that I'd arrest him if he ran him tomorrow. And he ran him anyway. And he won 2 championships. But it was 48 hours. As I remembered it, it was 24 because it was the same weekend, and it's January 1 weekend when they have their championships. So I guess it was a Monday, but it was a holiday first of the year or something. So I altered the truth. Not purposely, but... And my assistant got very angry with me, saying, that man knew it and you altered the truth. I said, hang on a minute. Whether it's 24 hours or 48 hours, he still needed resting. And Charivari ended up in the Hunter Valley over here and had some nice babies that won Group 1 races. But studying you ask me what I like about horses. You know, they don't lie to you. And if you're fair with them, they will give you 100% of themselves day after day after day. Look what they've done for the human race. And we say, just put another harness on them and pull down a few more trees, plow another hectare of land, run another race, jump another fence. We just demand, demand, demand. And we need to do far less demand and more encouragement.
Chautauqua is a horse that has caused all sorts of problems here in Australia for himself, his owners, and ultimately his career has been put on ice permanently because of his unwillingness to leave the barriers and race with the field. I know that there were attempts to get you here to Australia to work with the horse. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. What is your view on Chautauqua, if you don't mind me asking, having observed his behaviour and been close enough to those connected with him to understand what the depth of the issues are?
Well, it's interesting that you started this question with a sentence. I know Chautauqua has caused a lot of problems for his owners and people in racing and stuff. Chautauqua did not cause those problems. It's the people that caused the problems. Chautauqua is a horse. He doesn't want problems. He's a domestic horse. If Chautauqua had no mistakes made by human beings, there never would be the resistance to go out through that daylight that was opening up to him. None whatsoever. Oh, he just doesn't want to race anymore. What? When they pull him out of the stall, 30 lengths behind the field, he goes and wins the test. Don't tell me he doesn't want to race anymore. I mean, that is, anybody could see that. He loves to race. He doesn't want what happened. And I've seen enough videos that I have an opinion of what happened, but I don't want to foist my opinion on anybody. I think hundreds of mistakes were made. Chautauqua didn't make this decision after all those years of racing without it being a human-caused problem. Believe me. And I saw a lot of the human-caused problems on videos that they provided me in California when they were asking me to come. I would have loved to had an opportunity not to put anybody else down and not to even say that they made mistakes. Because the first thing I would say is I make a lot of mistakes every day. The difference might be that I keep my eyes open and try to learn from those mistakes. There are people who say, I didn't make any mistakes, it's him. And they blame the horse. To blame a horse for anything is like blaming the night for being dark. It's a natural thing. Horses can't make it up. The night gets dark. One time when I came to Australia and did on a tour right across Australia, a guy that studies the stars, what do you call those people?
Astrologer?
He was an astrologist. He's still an astrologist in America. Wanted to come down here with me and go on the, his wife was a fan of mine with the horses. But he studied astrology. He studied, and I want to see them from the Southern Hemisphere. And he went right across this country with me. And I called him the day I remember hearing for the first time. To blame a horse for anything is like blaming the night for being dark. And I called him and I said, what would happen if we had 24-hour daylight? And he said, oh, my word, that would be the worst thing in the world. Why do you say that? Well, he said, first of all, it would take two suns, one on one side of the earth and one on the other. And he said, there's planets where they have 24 hours a day of daylight. no life there, because you would boil if it didn't cool off at night. The fact that the sun goes away for half the time is the only reason we could exist on this earth. And I thought, how prophetic is that? Mm-hmm. The night being dark is a natural plus factor in our lives. And to blame a horse for anything, they cannot plan to go against us. They cannot decide they don't want to do something, so they just, you know, dictate to us. They can't do it. It's us that make the mistake. And we have to stop blaming the horse for anything. Oh, he kicked the farrier. All right. He did? Yeah. What did the farrier do then? Well, he gave him a good one with a rasp up the belly. Oh, he might kick the next farrier too, you know. And things like that. Typically, people who are in the horse industry will tend to blame the horse rather than blame the human elements in the horse's life. And that's a big mistake.
Mm. So where to from here, Monty? You've come to the sales and bought some yearlings on behalf of a client. Will they remain in Australia to be trained, or are they heading to the US? Can I ask that?
You can ask that. And one of the sellers loved his filly. We bought all fillies. And loved his filly. And he, because I was there and it looked like I was the one buying, is she going to go to California? I don't want her to go to California. No, she's going to remain here. All of them are going to remain here. Absolutely. They're all going to remain here. And I just love the ones I got. I wish I could have gotten even more, but you have to have some kind of a budget. And I want them to do well, of course. And I think we chose some good fillies, so we will see.
Will you influence who trains them?
I'm sorry?
Will you influence the decision as to who will train them?
That is something that I've already agreed to, at least at the outset. But I'm being placed in a position where I could make a change with that if I chose to make the recommendation of a change. But I'm pleased with where we are right now. And you ask me where I go from here. I go straight back to Germany, to Equitana in Essen, Germany. And I'm doing that one for all of my certified instructors in Germany who do such a great job. And they are going to do a show, and I'm going to ride a horse in there and just be the mentor, if you will. It'll be fun. And I'm going to be in a booth signing books for them and encouraging people to take their courses and things like that.
So you still ride quite a bit?
Not quite a bit, but I do ride, and I can ride. And I have a wonderful horse that I ride when I'm home. And I'm going to be riding a Rainer in Essen, Germany next week that they tell me is a champion. So I'm going to look like I know what I'm doing out there, apparently, if I can just stay out of his way. It's a lot of fun.
Do you prefer horses or people?
I'm a human being, and I love people. I really do. It's just too bad that some people, in my opinion, some people have a bad intention, and horses never have a bad intention. Every single horse wants to be your friend if it can. People speak to me with words, and that's comforting and it's good. And I love people that I love. I really do, more than any animals, I think. But I love horses. And on my birthday this past year, 2018, May 14th, 2018, one of the female deer in a family group of wild deer that I've worked with for 48 years, I've learned so much more from that family of deer about the true flight animal, even than horses. They've taught me so much about pure flight. They're 100 times more sensitive about flight than horses are. And Ruby, I know 5 generations of Ruby's family, brought me the most beautiful little pair of twins you could ever imagine. And she had had 3 singles in the years prior to that. And here she comes with these twins, still wet from being born. And she still had remaining afterbirth on her. And I said, Ruby, look at you. You have 2 of the most beautiful little babies. And the babies are born wild, really wild. And they never can understand how their mothers could come to a human being. But I'm now the only person that ever touched them up until recently. And then now I have a student that's touching some of them. Ruby, this is great. Come on, you two, come over. No, no, they're wild. And I looked up all of a sudden, and I see about 100 meters from me, the smallest deer I ever saw in my life. I can tell you that the deer weighed 3 pounds, and it was a male, and it was this tall. It was like a little doll, like somebody made it. And it was so weak it couldn't walk. And my wife was there, and our oldest daughter was there. She's 62 now. And my wife had a phone and got my veterinarian on the phone. And this baby was so weak that it tripped on the lawn and fell in a heap. And I was explaining to him about it, and he said, "Wow, Monty, you can do whatever you want. It's a late implant. She probably had a heat cycle 24 days after she got pregnant with the twins. And it's probably the same one because the breeding male stays there and he's the biggest, toughest one. But that one's 24 days premature, probably. Not, the other two weighed about 14 pounds each. And here's this tiny little thing, so weak." And he said, "You can do what you want, but it'll be dead in the morning anyway. It'll die. And even if it didn't die tomorrow, it'll die because the internal organs won't be properly developed." And that's what I learned in vet school anyway. So you can try whatever you want, you know. My wife said to me, "I already raised my family. If you're going to take him in, you're going to do all the work." And I said, "Oh, just get me one of your hammers from the house then, and I'll hit him in the head and feed him to the coyotes here." The coyotes were dodging through the bushes. She said, "You can't do that." I said, "Of course I can't do that. I'm taking him in." And she loaned me a dog crate. And I put him in it, and he didn't die that night. He was alive the next morning. And I had human formula. And I gave it to him, and I put some of my immune bolstering thing in, and I thawed out some mare colostrum. And I gave him some of that the next day. And he nursed a bit. And when I left 2.5 weeks ago, he was about 35 kilos. And he's the biggest baby born to that family group in 2018. And he's sleek and big and strong. And he still thinks he's 3 pounds. And I am his father, his grandfather, his uncle. I am everything in his life. He doesn't like it when I leave. He gets very upset. It took me 2 weeks to graft him. The first trip I had to make took me 2 weeks to graft him onto my wife so that he would take a bottle from her. But he was on the end of the bottle at that time. But the bottle helped to get him grafted onto my wife so she could go in his pen, because he won't let the men on the farm go near him. But to me, he'll come and just get up and give me a kiss here under the ear. And I love him. You ask me, do I like animals better than human? horses better than humans. The Queen named him. She's the best namer of animals on Earth, the Queen. And I talked to her and I sent her some photographs of him. Cutest little thing you ever saw. No bigger than my hand, you know. And she said, "Oh, Monty, I've never named a deer." And I said, "Your Majesty, you name animals the best of anybody in the world. And please, could you just give him a name?" So I got an email back. And it didn't say, "I suggest," or "What do you think of?" It said, "His name is Benediction." Benediction. I called her on the phone. I had to talk to her about some horses anyway. I called her, "Your Majesty, this is a wee little humorous kind of deer. Benediction is an awfully big name for him. He needs a proper name. Monty, I'm in love with that deer. You've sent all these pictures through and they keep coming through. And what he's done for you is overwhelming. And Benediction is a blessing. And he was sent to you as a blessing. So his name is Benediction. Now you can call him Ben, or you can call him Benny. But his name is Benediction." And I said, "Your Majesty, that's the best thing I've ever heard in my life. I'll call him Benny the Blessing." She said, "Oh, you Americans, you would give him a mobster's name, wouldn't you? But he's Benny the Blessing. And I love him to death. And he doesn't know he's big now and strong. He would come and get right up in my lap and give me a kiss right here. And he still thinks he's a little baby deer. But he knows how to run and buck and play. And he plays with my wife's dog. And he controls the dog completely. A deer controls a predator. So I can't release him yet, but I'm gradually moving him into the wild. But I have to be careful because he doesn't know who's going to eat him and be doing him harm, you know? And I don't want him to die that way. Mm. I would love it if he would live to be 15 and die of natural causes, you know? I won't be around. Mm. But when I leave shorts and socks and T-shirts, and they put them out about 3 days. They last, and he puts his head on them like this and wonders where I am and why I'm not there. Mm. Wants to hear my voice. Huh. I've got in this hotel, I have an album of pictures of him, and I just love him so much.
Yeah. The Queen and you talk horses a bit then. You've had a long-standing relationship with her now, but what do you talk about?
Gosh, we talk about so many things. And she gave me a knighthood, you know. And the knighthood came as an MVO. Mm. That's her own knighthood. That's not governmental. I know we're going a long time, and I realize, but that's me. And you can do whatever you want. But some of these things are important to me. And my knighthood is important to me because it was given to me in her office. And I have this 62-year-old daughter that said, "Please get me a picture of her giving you the medals." I said, "Debbie, you can't take a camera into that part of Buckingham Palace. Not possible. Dad, it's so important. Could you just ask if a picture could be taken of getting the medals?" "Debbie, you can't do it. A camera doesn't go in her office." "Dad, could you just ask?" "Fine." Ja-ja-ja-ja-ja. "Helen, Mrs. Cross, she is who I do all arrangements with for the Queen. Mrs. Cross, I have a daughter." At the time, she was 58 or something. 58-year-old daughter. "And here's the deal." And she's asked me to ask. And she said, "Monty, a camera can't go in that area." I know. "But if you're ever asked, I asked. So that my daughter knows I didn't go back on my word. I said I would ask. And she said, okay. You know it can't happen, but okay. So I go there and I meet Mrs. Cross, Helen, in the waiting room there. They've already put me through the wand and all that stuff. And I go there often, so they know me, but they still take their, you know, risk, what do you call it, the security. And she said, oh, the Queen's waiting. Down the hall we go. Tuck, tuck, tuck. Your Majesty, yes, yes. And I look in, and the Queen is standing in the middle of her office with a big smile on her face, holding my medals. And I thought, oh, this is incredible. Cowboy from California. And I walk straight toward her, and kapoor, 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 the flashbulbs start going off. Flashbulbs. And I didn't say a word. I went on. I never mentioned it. I know the lady that was over there. She went out a door over there. We spent an hour together talking about horses and this and that. But during the course of that conversation, she said to me, you know, Monty, this is not a knighthood about horses. It's the work you're doing with the military people. It's the work you're doing with youth at risk and with domestic abuse. That's what moved me to give you this knighthood. And so I want you to continue to do that work all pro bono. And I go do one right after Equitana. I go to the Plymouth in the south of England, Bovington military base. And we have one there. And Joe is military, Army brat. And she is certified instructor, and she does them. The stories just go on and on. The good we're doing is unbelievable. And they all get involved with horses.
Mm.
And it's a part of that flight animal thing where if the half a ton of horse flesh can trust you, you can trust your wife, your boss, your children, the people around you. And let's get it straight. And in 3 days, a year and a half ago, in 3 days, also at Plymouth, Bovington, at 20, and they do an empirical study at the end where the government takes over and they have to check off the boxes and so forth. And in the conclusion, the mathematics said that I had 169% improvement in their mental health in 3 days. 169% improvement.
It's remarkable.
Our government brags about a 5% improvement in a 6-month program. So I went away from there, recognizing myself as a genius. Mm. I am the best the world has ever known. Not really, it's the horses. But there's me thinking, oh, I nailed it. And then I heard right away, you know, we're going to have another one in June. And I was already booked in June in California. I couldn't go. Joe headed up the team that I've trained in England. They took it over. And they did a 20 veterans, 3 days, 175% improvement in their mental health. Oh my God. The Queen says, it's going on after me and after you and in perpetuity. It's gonna work. So that's where I am right now. There's a man called General Watt, General Reddy Watt, and he's running that program from a military standpoint, bringing the people in and making the arrangements and stuff. The horses. It's what I discovered, but it ain't me. It's the horses.
Mm.
I set up the format that gets them where they're going. But it's not that I'm the genius. It's the thing works. Same with domestic abuse in Guatemala and Brazil and Argentina and United States. The same with all over the world, domestic abuse. There's a 3 out of 5 chance that you have been physically abused by a male. Is that an earthquake? That's an earthquake, I think.
Construction.
The train went by or something. There's a 3 out of 5 chance that you've been physically accosted by a male. Maybe when you were 3 or 4. Maybe when you were 31 or 22. But a 3 out of 5 chance. Horses, 9 out of 10, are abused by, physically abused by human beings. 9 out of 10. Abuse as I describe it. The people who haul off and hit a horse with long tom, like you call them long toms, mm-hmm. lunch whip, they wouldn't call that abuse, but why did you do it? Well, son of a bitch did this or that, you know. Yeah, so what did the whip do then? It drove the adrenaline straight up. It drove the heart rate up. It drove all learning down. And it bolted away. Ah, yeah, but he needed it. For what purpose?
Mm. Mm. We've got a lot to thank horses for, haven't we?
Oh, man, don't we ever. You know, they did that movie, War Horse. They called me in, or the stage play, War Horse. Do you know the stage? Yeah. Well, the people that wrote War Horse, fans of mine, and they called me in to train the actors that run the horses, the puppeteers that are inside the horse. How can we make these horses look real and look like they're expressing the things that you've talked about? And so we trained them. And I took a live horse on stage in the, what they call, what do they call it? It's a thing where they introduce the play in the afternoon, and then the opening night is that night. And I took a live horse on the stage, and we talked to the audience about it and how we created these things and what the live horse does and what these horses do. And these guys did a thing that I wasn't expecting them to do. We had a sold-out audience, and the footlights are right there, and the audience is down there. And I'm leading this horse. His name was Pi. I'm leading him around, and they had Joey, the lead male horse, go at him, attack him aggressively, ears back, mouth open. And Pi nearly jumped into the audience. Oh, it was close. And they went, oh, my God. I said, I didn't teach you to do that. That's not what's supposed to be done. But I almost had a lap full of horse down there in the first row. But anyway, I thought, this will be a week-long play, and it'll go away.
It's still going.
And it's still going. And they took it to New York. And I personally did the program for New York. I've been so lucky. And those horses, those kids, all gay kids. I guess I can say that these days. I mean, they were sensitive kids that were gay kids. All you can say. They talked about it a lot. And they learned like a sponge. And they caused these horses. I was sitting with one of my instructors that on the opening night, that night, we went back to the hotel, we changed clothes, went back that night for the opening play. And she's sitting beside me, one of my instructors. Champion jockey she was when she was a jockey. And she's crying. Puppets. We've trained the people that are in there. And I said, Kelly, they're puppets. Shut up. And she was just living the part. And she's a part of it. And I couldn't cry about that play. But I could reason that she could. And they were talking about people abusing people. And it turns out that her father was extremely abusive to her.
Mm.
And she was working that through Joey and what was going on with him. So, you know, you ask me why I'm here. You ask me where I'm going from here. You ask me, do I like horses better than people? And all these wonderful questions. And I think now you know the answers to all of them. I am no longer just a human being. I'm not. I eat the same thing every day. I want to do things at the same time every day. I act so much like a horse. I'm 85% colorblind. Horses are 85% colorblind. I don't. I think God had a plan for me.
Mm. Yeah. Well, thank you for everything you do for horses.
Thank
for those
you for saying
that. Many of us that love them so much, and they've been a huge part of my life too, and my career. And it's really lovely to see what you've done for a long time, and the legacy that you will leave for a long, long time to come.
Thank you very much. I just want you to know that horses have given me a lot more than I've given them. And I need to go to work and give them more.
Mm.
I still have 10, 15 years, I suppose, to do that. Prince Philip's 96, so...
You've got a long way to go yet.
Yeah.
Great to meet you.
Yeah, good to meet you.